Imperial Leader, the life story of the foremost man of our time, Winston Churchill. No longer the young, impetuous adventurer, but a matured statesman, a leader with vision, Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, has attained a major step upwards in his ambitions to serve Britain to the best of his very wide ability. The year is 1912, and Churchill discusses his new job with his wife, Clementine, with whom he fell in love at first sight and made another of those quick decisions he has never regretted.
Clementine, my dear, I've realized a most dreadful reality. I've just awakened to a most astounding fact.
Winston, what is it? You alarm me.
I'm alarmed, too. I've been so busy for heaven knows how many years that I've forgotten I'm getting old.
Getting old? Oh, you'll never get old. Why, some people are worrying about having such a young man in charge of the Admiralty.
No, that doesn't alter the fact that the last time I thought of my age, I was in the 20s. Today, for no reason at all, I realize that I'm fast approaching 40. 40, Clementine.
So age would ever make any difference to you?
No. Age will never worry me if I live as a young man. A crisis makes me younger. Worry gives me added strength. In times of crisis, I feel like a boy.
With that Sydney Street glint in your eyes. I know, darling. And I'm very fortunate to have a husband who is always young.
But how lucky am I to have a wife with whom I can discuss my most critical problem.
And what is your most critical problem now?
I've been appointed to the Admiralty to make a drive for greater efficiency. But here's the droll point. The Germans are actually welcoming my appointment. They're saying Churchill's first and foremost on the economy. He'll see that the service is reduced. Typical German short-sightedness. Of course, economy has been a guiding principle with me, but not to the sacrifice of security. I'm going into the Admiralty to make a clean sweep of old fittings and furnishings. I'm going to be unpopular, but it's got to be done.
A hateful task, though, to dismiss people who have been there for years.
When the fate of a country is at stake, its very existence threatened, there's time for only one guiding principle in the choice of personnel, the best man for the job. I myself would step down if directed, but if I felt somebody else could do better than I. Oh, well, I'll have to see Sir Arthur Wilson. He's the first to feel the axe. Oh, but let's forget business tonight, my dear. Shall we go and see how our son is making out?
Oh, he's sleeping soundly. The medicine doctor left has removed all cause for outcry and
one of those invidious tasks which falls upon me. I know you will understand, Sir Arthur. I regret this had to happen, but I must have men who are in agreement with my policy.
I'm not complaining, Mr. Churchill. I realized when you took office that my days were numbered.
Not because of any prejudice against you, Sir Arthur. As First Sea Lord, you've done splendid work. But you must have been aware that changes were coming.
Oh, yes, yes. When I first heard the news of your appointment, I said to the other Sea Lords, we are to have new masters. If they wish us to serve them, we will do so. If not, they will find others to carry on the work.
Well, I gave you your chance, Sir Arthur, when I sent you a minute about the creation of a naval war staff.
An innovation of which you knew I disapproved.
And since you refused to countenance such an innovation, I had to find a man less prejudiced. Sir Francis Bridgman, therefore, takes over immediately.
I wish him luck. Sir Francis is a very sound man.
Well, it's sporting of you to say so, Sir Arthur. I suppose you know the other changes?
I heard that Prince Louis of Battenberg was to be Second Sea Lord and Captain Pakenham fourth.
Yes. Rear Admiral Briggs will be retained as Controller and Third Sea Lord. In addition, Vice Admiral Sir George Callaghan will replace Sir Francis Bridgman in command of the Home Fleet, and Sir John Jellicoe as second in command.
Practically a clean sweep, in fact.
Well, you know what they say about new brooms, Sir Arthur. Rightly or wrongly, I believe that great changes should be made. I'm going to make those changes as soon as I can.
So I observed. For the sake of the country, I hope the changes will be for the better. And now, Mr. Churchill, if you've quite finished...
Oh, there's just one other matter.
Mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister has told me he's willing to submit your name to the King for a peerage. How do you feel about that?
A peerage? What would I do with such a thing?
It would be quite ridiculous.
And you refuse?
I most certainly do.
Well, in that case, there's nothing more to be said except thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye, Mr. Churchill. And I wish you well.
We'd like to see you, sir.
Be here. Isn't he the man who refused an appointment in the Atlantic Fleet?
Yes, sir. He's been unemployed for about 18 months.
Oh, I'd better see him, I suppose. Show him in.
Yes, sir. The First Lord will see you now, Admiral Beatty.
Thank you. Sit down, Beatty. But what can I do for you? You can give me a job, First Lord. But I understand you were offered an appointment and refused it.
Yes, it wasn't what I wanted.
Well, you can't afford to pick and choose in this service, Beatty. There are many candidates and few appointments.
I know that. And I know that after 3 years' unemployment, I'll probably be retired. That's why I'm here now. You're my last chance.
Let me be frank, Beatty. I've been warned against you. I've been told that you've gone ahead too fast. And that your heart isn't in the service.
That's not true. It's because my heart is in the service. By where I am today, I have the greatest enthusiasm for the Navy. I see in it the most perfect instrument to bring about world peace. Provided we make it perfect.
Now, how do you think you could do that? No, first of all, tell me what you think is wrong.
I think it's time the Navy turned at its feet. For years now, we've been existing on the memory of Trafalgar. But this is the 20th century. Naval warfare is going to be an entirely different matter. England's been living in a dream of the past. But Germany, the vision of the future.
Where did you learn all this, Beatty?
Nowhere I could learn it, except out of my own head. Why, the only decent book on sea power was written by an American.
Oh, so you've read Ma on sea power, have you?
Yes, because I wanted to, not because I had to. A naval officer isn't encouraged to read books of that kind.
Beatty, how'd you like to be my naval secretary?
You really mean that, First Lord?
Of course I mean it. I'm going to need men with courage enough to think for themselves. The appointment's yours if you want it, Beatty.
Phew. But I was just wondering when I was going to be kicked out.
As you know, Churchill, Haldane has gone to Berlin to discuss the new German Navy law with the government there. Now I suggest that as a counterpart of the Haldane mission, you should make a speech on our own naval position.
Well, I'd intended to do that at Belfast, Mr. Asquith. There was so much rioting and disorder there over the proposed Home Rule Bill that I thought it wiser to select another occasion and another place.
Have you anything in mind?
I thought of going to Glasgow to inspect some of the shipbuilding works along the Clyde. That would provide a very favorable opportunity.
It would indeed. I wish you would make definite plans. Go to Glasgow as soon as possible and state very plainly our root intention for the benefit of Germany.
Here for a while, my dear. The lounge is empty and I feel tired.
Oh, I'll be glad when we leave Scotland. Look at the weather. It's dreadful.
Father! Father!
It's a weary life at times. Right now, I'm worried.
About your speech?
Yes. What I say may affect great affairs. What I say may, yes, it may indeed affect the future of the British Empire.
You're serious?
Quite serious.
Harper! Harper!
Oh, steward, will you please send out the newspaper?
Yes, sir.
You see, I have to warn Germany, and yet pacify Germany. No, it's always Germany. I feel sometimes that nothing can stay the inevitable clash. And then again, I say to myself, but this is a civilized world of thinking men and women.
It must be a civilized world. Consider our progress, our enlightened thought.
But didn't Madame de Stael say, thinking calms men of other nations. It inflames the Germans. And they're fast becoming inflamed with that Bismarck credo, the great questions are to be settled not by speeches and majority resolutions, but by blood and iron.
Your paper, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Anything exciting?
The Kaiser's speech to the Reichstag.
What's happening?
Quite a lot. The Kaiser opened the Reichstag and announced bills for the increase of both army and navy.
And where will that lead?
To Armageddon, I'm afraid. Listen to the Kaiser's words. It is my constant duty to maintain and to strengthen on land and water the power of defense of the German people, which has no lack of young men fit to bear arms. No lack of young men fit to bear arms. And it's true, that's the pity of it.
A military nation. Always a military nation. Can we expect to live peacefully alongside a nation such as that?
It seems hopeless. And yet we must go on. So close to us in race and yet so widely different. Ruled always by religion of valor. Ruled by the thought of Nietzsche's magnificent blonde beast, avidly rampant for spoil and victory.
What is that doctrine, Winston?
Nietzsche's philosophy, accepted by the Germans, tells them, ye have heard how in old times it was said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. But I say unto you, blessed are the valiant, for they shall make the earth their throne. And then it goes on to say, and ye have heard men say, blessed are the peacemakers. But I say unto you, blessed are the war makers. On it goes, that's all I can remember.
How can they believe in a gospel like that? Blessed are the war makers. They might as well say, blessed are the murderers.
They don't understand. Commercial success, military fervor, a flamboyant monarch, and this philosophy combines to make Germany madly ambitious. Well, enough for the present. They say they have no lack of young men fit to bear arms. Neither do we suffer a lack. I know what to say in my speech now. I know what words to use. And I shall use them to good purpose.
Winston Churchill, about to make one of the vital speeches of his career. A speech of strength. Yet words that will invite Germany to seek the path of reconciliation and peace. Words that cover a declaration that Britain is mighty, proud and strong, and will not yield to the threat of military force, no matter what the cost. Winston Churchill, leading now the incomparable British Navy, inheriting the traditions of a long line of forebears, stands firmly on the threshold of destiny.